So I'd like to thank the organizers for the opportunity to speak here. It's really interesting to be part of a kind of groundbreaking way of having a conference, and I've learned a lot so far. So my title is, I think, Higher Products. If I remember right, my title is Higher Products in Supersymmetric Quantum Field Theory. So it's a report of joint work soon to appear with Chris Beam, David Ben-Zvi, Matt Bullimore, and Tudor Demofte. So my aim in this talk, well, really the aim of the whole work, is just to describe a structure, what I'll call a kind of overlooked structure. It's probably not fair. I mean, I'm sure it wasn't overlooked by everyone, but I think it has been overlooked at least by some chunk of the community, including the five of us, and we were interested when we found out about it. So I'll call it an overlooked, at least by some people, an overlooked structure in supersymmetric quantum field theory. Overlooked by us, but I think it will look very familiar to some of the people in this at this particular conference. Many of you probably know about it already in some form. So it'll look familiar. So how does this work now? There's some height above which I should not go.
About this side, it's fine.
Oh, okay. Here it doesn't, okay.
There's one,
so if I do this, no, that, not that. So it'll look very familiar to, let's say, practitioners of topological field theory, but I mean the kind of modern view of topological field theory, not the sort of Atiyah axioms that we grew up with. So we've been thinking about this for a while. Recently, there appeared a paper by Elliott and Safronov, and what I'm going to say could be viewed as a kind of companion to that paper. I think, in fact, Chris Elliott maybe gave a talk about this paper on the other side of this conference. So you've heard about this, but we here have not heard about it. I'd say this is a kind of companion to Elliott Safronov on EN algebra structures. In supersymmetric quantum field theory. In a way, in this talk, I'm going to be much less ambitious, actually, than Elliott and Safronov. So in particular, I'm going to focus on the structures that are visible kind of in homology rather than on chain level. So I would say this is somehow not the deepest part of the story, but on the other hand, even here, there's something that we didn't know about before, which is fun, so I'll just talk about this. So let me get started. So in quantum field theory, on space-time, say Rn, so let's just take the space-time to be R to the n. But in that R to the n, we're allowed to insert various kinds of operators. Operators or defects, I'll use the word operators. Here's R to the n. We might have some local operators inserted at points. We might have some extended operators of various dimensions. And in a quantum field theory, the operators carry labels. Labels of different kinds. For my purpose, I'm going to focus mostly on the labels that are carried by the local operators, the point insertions. And I think of those as just living in a vector space. So So associated to this point, I would have some element phi 1. Associated to this, I have some element phi 2, all living in this vector space of local operators. Now, maybe to make this literally true, that there's literally a vector space of operators associated to a point, I should talk about a conformal theory. And in other theories, I should talk about operators living on little balls, and I should talk about the dependence on the size of the ball. I'm not going to worry about that structure too much, because it's going to be washed out anyway when I pass to homology. But if you like, you could think I'm talking about a conformal theory where it's literally in local operators at points. So I want to talk about symmetries in quantum field theory. So one of the basic symmetries that we often have is translation invariance. So translation invariance means, in particular, that the group of translations of R to the n, it was R to the n acting on itself by translations, acts on everything in the theory. Particularly, it acts on this vector space of local operators. It's implemented by so-called momentum operators. So P mu, the translation in the mu direction. Let me do this from 1 up to n. So these operators act on the space of... So again, here, I guess I've got another board. And so P mu essentially acts as the derivative in the mu direction. But to say what I mean by that, so for example, if you compute a correlation function of this quantum field theory involving the operator, let's write it over here. An operator phi inserted at a point, and then maybe a bunch of other things inserted at other points. You take the derivative of that in the mu direction, that's supposed to be equal to the correlation function with the operator p mu phi inserted. And then to say that p mu is a symmetry, is to say that if you act with p mu on all of the operators, then the translation function is the correlation function is invariant under translating all the operators by the same amount. When you work out what that means in terms of the individual derivatives, what it means is that p mu, if you apply p mu to all the operators, you just get zero. So for example. So it acts as a derivation. So okay. So that's what I mean by translation invariance. So now I'm interested in a structure that in quantum field theories that have not just translation invariance, but this supersymmetry, which extends the translation invariance. So now let's suppose that the theory has, I'll say Z2 odd. There's going to be a Z2 rating in the story, and these operators will be odd with respect to that Z2 rating. Operators of two kinds, I'll call them Q and Q mu, such that so Q squares to zero. Sorry, these are also going to be symmetry operators in the same sense as P mu was a symmetry. Where Q squares to zero and the graded commutator, so the anti-commutator of Q and Q mu gives you P mu. So we're realizing the translation now as the bracket of these sort of more primitive things, Q and Q mu. So an example of where this kind of structure comes from is to take Q to be what you call a topological supercharge. In a supersymmetric field theory. So usually in a supersymmetric field theory, you write something very similar to this, except that the Qs are carrying a spinner index. So here I've sort of already chosen a relabeling of the supercharges. I call one of them just Q and call the other ones Q mu. But at least on R to the N, I'm not modifying the theory. I'm just modifying how I label the supercharges. OK, so suppose you have this structure. Because Q squared is zero, you can talk about the cohomology of Q. And from now on, we're going to talk mostly about the cohomology of Q. So suppose we look at things that are annihilated by Q. So suppose you have a bunch of operators, phi I, which are all in the kernel of this operator Q. So all Q phi I is zero. And then let's compute a correlation function. Operator phi 1 inserted at x1, phi 2 at x2, up to phi n of xn. And then insert at the front one which is q exact. And I'll just write that one q phi of x. Well, because all of these have q phi equals 0, this is the same as acting with q on all of them. Q of phi of x, phi 1 of x1. Phi n of xn. I mean, this involves n plus one terms, but all of them are zero except for the first one where qx1 phi. And so the statement that q is a symmetry says that this correlation function is zero. So what that means is that as long as we look at only q closed operators, the q exact ones are decoupled. So as far as the correlation functions go. We might as well only look at the cohomology classes. So the cohomology is kind of a natural thing to look at. So that says that this correlation function, which I'll write product of phi I of xi. So I'm reviewing somehow very well-known stuff. It doesn't depend on the actual representatives. It only depends on their cohomology classes. So in the cohomology of Q. And let me call that script A. Script A is going to be the local operators, the Q cohomology of local operators. And this is the thing that's supposed to be insensitive to exactly, you know, how big of a disk I take or anything like that. Okay, then another thing you can say about these correlation functions is that they also don't depend on the position. Why do they not depend on the position? Let's see, I guess I have to start erasing stuff. Well, it's actually slightly wrong to say they don't depend. They locally don't depend on the position. They're locally constant functions of the position. Why is that? So suppose again that we look at a Q closed operator. From now on, I'm basically only going to look at Q closed operators. Then the derivative of that operator, we said the derivative is implemented by this operator p mu. Well, that's the bracket of q and q mu acting on phi. But here phi is annihilated by q, so that's the same as q of q mu phi. And so this is q exact. And we just said correlation functions, if everything's q closed, then the q exact things will decouple. So this says here that the derivatives will decouple. That says that the correlation function is constant, locally constant as a function of the positions. It's a locally constant function. Of the xi's. Okay, so because of that, this is a pretty familiar structure, and one of the things that people use it for is to construct a kind of algebraic structure on this space A. So what can you do once you know this? Thank you. So what we can do is we can put a product structure on A, just an ordinary product, not a product depending on positions or anything. So given phi 1 and phi 2 living in A, let's define a new class in A, phi 1 dot phi 2. That'll be another local operator. And the way that I make that local operator, roughly speaking, is I take phi 1 inserted at x1, phi 2 inserted close by at a point x2, and now I take the limit as x2 approaches x1. Phi 1 of x. So I guess I should say the class, the cohomology class of phi 1 dot phi 2 is equal to the limit of the cohomology class of the insertion here. So of course this, you know, as a product of operators in the full supersymmetric field theory, this definitely depends on exactly where you inserted them. But the claim is that because of what I just showed you, the correlation function, the class in the Q homology doesn't depend. And so in particular, you can think of taking x2 as close as you like to x1. In the limit where x2 approaches x1, this thing looks like a local operator just inserted at a single point. And so in this way, you get a product structure on A. Okay. So we get phi 1 dot phi 2. Element of A. So that's a product. Now, if the dimension is greater than 2, this product is commutative. In other words, phi 1 dot phi 2 is the same as phi 2 dot phi 1. Why is that? Well, okay, here I didn't even specify in which direction I take the limit. In dimension n greater than or equal to 2, the configuration space of pairs of points in the plane is connected, so it can't matter which direction I take the limit. The cohomology class is locally constant as a function of the positions. So because the configuration space of pairs of points in, say, a little ball, so we think of all this as happening inside a little ball, because C2 of ball is connected. And likewise, it's also associative, in fact, even in dimension one. Sorry, so I guess in dimension one, I should say what fails. So if n equals one, there's, you know, we could define phi one dot phi two with this picture. So here's phi one of x one, phi two of x two. X2 approaching X1, or we could have them in the opposite order, phi2 of X2 and phi1 of X1. Phi2 dot phi1. So phi1 dot phi2 is defined by this picture with phi2 to the right of phi1. Phi2 dot phi1 is defined by this picture with phi2 to the left of phi1. There's no way of interpolating between them without having them sit at the same point, which we don't allow. So in dimension one, there's no reason for this product to be commutative, because the configuration space of two points in the ball in one dimension is not connected. And similarly, so in either dimension, the product is always associative. And for example, it's easiest to say it in dimensions greater than two. That boils down to the fact the configuration space of 3 points in the ball is connected. So you can kind of, you can interpolate between a configuration where you multiply two of them first and take the third one far away, and a configuration where you multiply them in a different order. So fundamentally, this has to do with, you know, this has to do with just number of connected components in configuration spaces of points. And so this structure is called, sometimes called a topological ring.
So what's wrong in dimension one?
Well, in dimension one, there's like six different, so in dimension one, it's still associative. Of course, it's associative even in dimension one. I'm just saying the proof isn't that the configuration space of 3 points is connected, because it's not connected. So there's, so we call this the topological ring. So what we said is that these the Q cohomology in a quantum field theory with this Q and Q mu, which might come from twisting a supersymmetric field theory, the Q cohomology has the structure of just an absolutely ordinary ring, even in algebra. So this is a very well-known thing, but it actually has a little bit more than just the structure of a ring, and that's the thing that I wanted to explain. So to explain it, let me remind you of another construction that people in supersymmetric field theory know and love, which is called descent. So let's start again. So we're given phi, and suppose that it's closed, so q phi equals zero. Now we're going to make a tower of extended operators starting from this local operator. So what we do is, I'll say phi 0 will just be the original phi. I'll define a new thing, phi 1, and this is going to be kind of a form-valued operator. So I'll write dx mu, and then I'll write a bunch of operators, one for each mu. And the operator that I write is just q mu phi of x. Okay, so for every mu, I've got these operators q mu, I just act with them on my original guy phi. I get q mu phi of x, multiply by dx mu. So this is now like a one-form valued operator, or an operator valued one-form. And you can keep going like this. So let's make a two-form, q mu q nu phi, dx mu dx nu, and so on. So the total thing, I guess, so the total thing would be just to sum them all up, right? Phi star of x is the sum of phi k of x. So now it's a sort of operator valued in all forms, on R to the n. Now what's special about this construction? What's special is that we've engineered it so that, so for example, if you compute d phi 1 of x, d phi 0 of x. Yeah, let's just do it. What's d phi 0 of x? That's, I take the derivative of phi of x, p mu phi of x, dx mu. But as we said before, p mu of phi is just q mu of phi. I'll rewrite it. So in other words, what we got is that d phi 0 is, well, q of q mu phi dx mu, that's q of phi 1. And similarly, d phi 1 is q of phi 2. And so on. So this total operator that we made, d phi star, obeys the equation d phi star equals q phi star. Okay. So these higher operators, this higher operator phi 1 is not exactly q closed, but it is so up to the derivative of something. And conversely, the derivative is q exact, and as we said before, it's q exact in a very specific way. It's trivialized by this specific thing, and now we're going to use that extra that extra little juice to get something new. So let's do the following now. So now let's take any chain, or any K chain, I'll call it gamma. I'm still doing everything inside R to the N. Let's define an operator, kind of extended operator. I'll write phi. So before I put it at a point, now I'll write phi of gamma will be just the integral over gamma of the K-form part of phi. So this is now an extended operator. It's not a local operator anymore. It lives on this chain gamma, whatever it was. But because of this relation, this operator, well, is it Q closed or not? So Q phi of gamma is, well, what is it? It's the integral over gamma of Q phi k. Let's just write Q phi star. I don't have to keep track of whether things are k plus 1 or k minus 1. Integral over gamma of Q phi star, that's the integral over gamma of d phi star. So that's the integral over the boundary of gamma of phi star, which is the operator phi attached to the boundary. OK, so here's the relation. Q applied to phi of gamma is phi associated to the boundary of gamma. So we have these new operators. So here in my space-time, here's gamma, here's the boundary of gamma. We said Q of phi of gamma is phi of the boundary of gamma. So in particular, if the boundary of gamma is 0, so the most obvious special case would be to take something closed, right? Then you get an honest Q closed extended observable in this way. If Q gamma is 0, if the boundary of gamma is 0, then Q of the operator is 0. So then you get if this has no boundary, then you get an honest Q closed operator from it. And then a little more is true. You know, because of this relation, the cohomology class of that operator depends only on the homology class of gamma. Depends only on the homology class of gamma. Well, all right. Depends only on the homology class again. Yeah.
So to what extent does this like exhaust all of the higher degree, all of this like higher defect operators?
You mean do you get them all by descent from local operators?
Yeah.
The answer is you don't.
So the
question was, do you get all the extended operators by performing descent starting from local operators? And the answer is no, you don't get all of them.
You do, if you're in a perturbative setting. This is what finalization algorithms are for.
You're saying this is already sort of built into the story of factorization algebras when there's a Q.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I had some random line operator and I put it on an interval, then there's something going on at the end. And I could have tried to re-engineer my line from starting with those endpoints.
Typically, a line operator won't have any gauge invariant boundary conditions, because that would be a G invariant vector in the representation.
So it would be zero.
I would be cautious here in different notions of extended operator. These are definitely not line defects in any sense. They're not like Wilson lines in any way. They're not like two-foot operators. They are just averages of local operators. They're not extended operators in the sense of defects.
Another question. So are you thinking here of a different space-time than Rn, since there are no interesting homology clauses in Rn?
Very good, very good. So that's the next thing I was about to say. So at first, this looks like it's not going to give you anything interesting, right? Because we do it in R to the N. Yeah, so just to say, before coming to that, just to set the stage for something later, let me just emphasize, we're saying that the cohomology class of the Q cohomology class of this operator depends only on only on the homology class. So, for example, you could apply that to even to points to recover the statement we had before. So, the operator inserted at x is homologous to the operator inserted at y in Q cohomology, but for a specific reason, namely that their difference is the boundary of this one chain. Okay, but now you say indeed. So, what are we going to do? With these extended operators phi of gamma. So historically, the first application of this idea is due to Witten in the paper where he introduced topological quantum field theory. And so there the application was to build a version of the theory, so-called twisted version of the theory. Twisted version of a supersymmetric theory that has the same symmetry structure, in particular has this supercharged Q, but has it even on a curved manifold, on some N manifold. So in his example, it was a four manifold, which actually supports homologically non-trivial cycles. Then you could insert these descendants on the homologically non-trivial cycles and get something new. On a non-trivial cycle in X. So in his application, he applied it to N equals 2 supersymmetric Yang-Mills to build the Donaldson invariance of a four-manifold. You needed to have not just the partition function, but also the correlation functions of these extended operators. Now, on R to the N, you would first think, well, this is not going to give me anything new, at least as far as cohomology is concerned. But there is something you can do. So what can you do on R to the N? Well, you could do the following thing. So now I'm going to define this new product structure. On the chiral ring. So suppose I have two operators, Q phi 1, or on the topological ring, I should say. Suppose I have two operators, phi 1 and phi 2. They're both Q close. Now I can imagine doing the following thing. Let's take one of the operators and insert it just, say at the origin or at some point x anyway. And now I'll take the other operator and I'll make its n minus 1 form descendant. And then I'll put that descendant on a little sphere . So now I'm taking phi 2 of this sphere, this n minus 1 sphere, linking x. So now, this configuration, now the fact that this sphere is homologically trivial in the whole R to the N now is not relevant. What's relevant is that it's homologically non-trivial in R to the N with this thing removed. There would be a singularity if I allowed the two operators to touch each other. So for that reason, this composite thing doesn't have to be trivial, and it's not trivial. On the other hand, it is independent of the radius of this sphere, and so I can again imagine taking the radius of this sphere to be very small, take a limit where the radius of that sphere gets smaller and smaller, and that'll define for me a new local operator. So let's call this radius r. So now I'll define the bracket. Let me emphasize again, I mean, to many people in the audience, this is a very familiar construction. So I'm not claiming any particular novelty for this construction. But I just want to kind of advertise that it exists. So we just take the sphere, and we take the sphere to be very small. And the limit is that radius goes to zero. We have a new local operator, which is built from phi 1 and phi 2. And it depends linearly. So it depends only on the cohomology classes of phi 1 and phi 2, and it depends linearly on them. So you're getting some new operation, A tends or A to A. That's what I call the secondary product. Okay. And then the first kind of basic fact about it
does that mean there's no singularities as r goes to zero?
Well, there would be a singularity at r equals zero, but at any small, at any finite value of r. In fact, the cohomology class, if you think of the Hilbert space associated to a big ball that contains the whole your whole sphere, then in the Q cohomology. Acting on operators inside of that ball, this thing is literally independent of R. So the only purpose of taking the R goes to zero limit is to allow you to put it into smaller and smaller balls, so that you can think of it as being like a local operator. But it's independent of R for the reason that that I said before, that in cohomology, these extended operators only depend on the homology class, right? So the big sphere is homologous to the small sphere, even in the R to the N with the puncture removed. Okay. So the first basic fact about this bracket is that it gives a Poisson structure. If I were keeping track of ratings, I would say a degree n minus 1 Poisson structure, Poisson bracket on A. So if n is odd, and you only keep track of the Z2 ratings, it's just an ordinary Poisson bracket. Particularly, it's skew symmetric. But in even dimensions, it's actually symmetric rather than skew symmetric on the bosons. So how do you prove that it's a Poisson bracket? Let's see. Yeah, I'll just say a word about why it's a Poisson bracket. What's that?
Little n.
N is the dimension. So all this was happening inside of R to the n. So I'm saying the property of this thing depends a little bit on whether n is even or odd, the symmetry property. Let me just sketch the idea of why it has this skew symmetry. So the sort of efficient way of proving that is to kind of expand your mind a little bit, and rather than thinking of forms so far I've talked about kind of operator valued forms on R to the n, but the better thing to do is to think about putting the forms directly on the configuration space of points. So let's extend, think of doing descent, so to speak, on the whole object phi 1 of x1, phi 2 of x2, to a form valued operator. I'll call it phi 1, phi 2 star on the configuration space of two points in the ball. And then, by the kind of manipulations I've been doing, what you show is that the binary operations that you can get by performing descent and integrating one thing around another just correspond to homology classes in the configuration space. So what you get is that every class, say alpha, in the configuration space of pairs of points in the ball gives a map, I'll call it star alpha, a kind of binary operation from A tensor A to A. So I showed you one such operation where you keep one point fixed and integrate the other one around. You could do the opposite thing. You could keep the other point fixed and integrate the first one around. Why are those two the same, or the same up to a sign? Well, it's just because the configuration space of two points is not a real complicated space, right? The configuration space of two points in a ball is just homotopy equivalent to just the sphere, the n minus one sphere. All you have to keep track of is the direction from one point to the other. And so in particular, it's n minus one homology where both of these things live is just the integers. So up to a sign, there's only one operation. Then you work out that sign, and you see that it's this minus one to the n. So then you could ask, what about the Jacobi identity? And the Jacobi identity comes from relation in, so that involves integrating two things around. So it's a relation in, I guess, H2n minus 2 of the configuration space of three points of the ball. Okay. Yet another thing you could do, say, to be concrete in three dimensions, you could imagine descending each one to a one form and integrate them around a little hop link. That also gives you a multiple of the same operation. And in general, a linking number between the two things is what controls that integer. Okay, fine. So then you might ask, how many operations like this are there? You know, is there some complicated thing you can do with 27 operators integrating them over some crazy cycles to get some further new operation? Okay, and the answer to that, so that's really a question about, you know, the topology of configuration spaces of points, right? And so fortunately the answer to that is known. And the answer is that you don't get anything new. So all operations we get in this way are just, they can all be built from the ordinary product and the Poisson bracket. So like if you have 10 things, you know, there's a lot of ways of making operations by combining the product and the Poisson bracket. All the operations that you get by doing this procedure are just built in that way. So that comes from, so this is a theorem. So the theorem is a sort of professional way of stating it, I hope, is that the homology of the little n disks operad is the degree n minus one Poisson operad. And if I understand well, this is essentially due to Cohen. Arnold, maybe only in the case of two dimensions?
Okay.
I think. So I learned about this from a review by Dev Sinha. But I think he said that it was Arnold only in some low dimension. So let me quickly say, I said that there's some structure in supersymmetric field theory that that we should pay attention to. So let me say what that structure is in a couple of examples. Well, maybe just one example, which is the sort of basic example that got us interested. So basic example is, let's suppose we're in three dimensions, and we take an n equals four supersymmetric sigma model. So let's now study an actual full-fledged quantum field theory. The supersymmetric sigma model, whose target is some hyperkähler space, I'll call it X. So that theory has a lot of square zero supercharges. Choosing one amounts to choosing a complex structure. So one of the, so it has like a CP1 worth of complex structures associated with the hyperkähler structure. If you choose one, then you get a Q and Q mu in the sense I described before, associated with the Rozanski-Witten twist of this theory. So choose a Q. In other words, choose a complex structure on X. So then X is just holomorphic symplectic. So from the point of view of that one complex structure, you would usually say that X is just a holomorphic symplectic manifold. Okay, so maybe now it's already obvious what the bracket is going to be. Let's just say it. So in this case, this new bracket is something pretty well known. Well, so first of all, what's A? So the topological ring is the del bar, the zero comma q part of the del bar cohomology of x. So in particular, you might as well think of the case I usually think about is the case x is just affine, so just holomorphic functions. So it's just all just the algebra of holomorphic functions on x. And then the Poisson bracket that it gets from this descent construction is the Poisson bracket coming from this holomorphic symplectic form. So anytime you have a holomorphic symplectic, well, anytime you have a symplectic manifold, the functions become a Poisson algebra. And here we're talking about the holomorphic version of that. So you get a holomorphic Poisson algebra. Okay. So I think, So far I've told you about some structure in supersymmetric field theory, which I think to many of you is probably already well known in some slightly different form. Let me say one last thing, one application of this, which I think might be new and was certainly interesting for us, let me say two applications. So one application, which at least for me was kind of satisfying, is that if this Poisson bracket, so now we understand that this Poisson bracket, which you might first have thought of as some kind of, you start with a hyperkähler manifold, then it has a holomorphic symplectic form, and so you get a Poisson bracket, but there's nothing particularly fundamental from the point of view of the original quantum field theory about that Poisson bracket. Okay, now we understand that's wrong. It comes from a topological thing, and in particular, that means that it should have a kind of non-renormalization property. So it's computable. So what does it mean? It means that this Poisson bracket, can be computed, just like the chiral ring, it can be computed either in the infrared or in the UV. Can be computed exactly either in the infrared or the UV. Now, there have been recently a lot of computations of the Poisson bracket on moduli spaces of three-dimensional n equals four theories. So literally for 3D theories, it's in work of Bullimore, Demofte, Gaiotto. And for theories, it's closely related to some computation where you start with a four-dimensional theory and reduce it on a circle. In both of those computations, somehow the key device is to go past to the infrared where the description is abelian and compute in that simpler abelian description. And it was always a little puzzling to me, why does it exactly work? Why is that on the nose the correct answer? So I want to say that this is part of the explanation of that. This is actually something in topological field theory. It can be computed both in the infrared and in the UV. Okay, so you might say that's just checking some box, some detail that I was confused about before. One other application is to something called omega background. So I'll just sketch what this is. So So this is something you can do pretty generally, but let's specialize to the specific case of a three-dimensional sigma model with n equals four supersymmetry. So this quantum field theory admits a deformation, which you sometimes think of as being kind of like doing the theory in a U1 equivariant way. So in the four-dimensional context, it was invented by Nekrasov. I think in three-dimensional theories, I think the first person to write it down is Yagi, who's here. So by U1, I mean literally you take the rotations in R3. So we're going to pick out an axis and make a rotation around that axis. We're going to deform the theory in a way that involves that rotation. So in the deformed theory, instead of working with the usual supercharge Q, you work with a deformed supercharge. So the deformation depends on a parameter, epsilon, a complex number. And the new deformed supercharge, instead of squaring to zero, squares to epsilon times the rotation. So think of this epsilon as being like a kind of equivariant parameter for U1. So now there's a picture. So now, instead of looking at the cohomology of this of Q, in the omega deformed theory, the thing you look at is the cohomology of this deformed operator Q epsilon. So let's define A epsilon. Well, first of all, we have to restrict to things that are rotation invariant in order for this even to square to zero. But let's do that. So we'll restrict to things that are rotation invariant. Then it makes sense to talk about the cohomology of this Q epsilon. Okay, so now we can ask, what algebraic structure does this thing have, right? It's not going to be necessarily a commutative algebra anymore, because the operators we're restricting to circle invariant. To have a local operator that's invariant under this thing, it has to, in particular, be stuck on the axis. So we're back in the situation morally of like one dimension, where the thing has no reason to be commutative. So you say, well, it's just some non-commutative algebra, but then there's a proposal that algebra. That the way it comes is that it comes as a deformation quantization of the original thing. So we started with some Poisson algebra. Now we turn on this omega background, and what we're supposed to get is the deformation quantization. So the proposal is that A epsilon is the deformation quantization of A. I think this proposal also was first written down by Yagi, although it had some antecedents in. Got some more Nitsky and Ido Ikuda Taki. Okay, so anyway, and you know, there's considerable evidence for this, so it's it seems to be true. But let's try to give a sort of simple explanation of it in the language that we've been using. So why is it true? In our language, we would say the reason why it's true is that if you do a sort of version of this descent construction that I've been describing, but adapted to this situation where you have Q epsilon here, what you find is that operations on A epsilon come from, so before it was just the homology of configuration spaces of points. Now it's going to be the equivariant homology of configuration spaces of points. So U1 equivariant homology of configuration spaces of points in a ball. And so in particular, the thing that we want to understand just has to do with operation involving two, it just involves this product. So it's going to be something in the equivariant homology of the configuration space of two points. Okay, so what's the situation? So that configuration space of two points, as we said, it's homotopy equivalent to just a sphere. But now we think of a sphere with rotation acting on it. It has two fixed points, the north pole and the south pole. And in ordinary homology, the north pole and the south pole would be homologous because there's, as we said, very explicitly, there's some path whose boundary is the north pole minus the south pole, right? So what you would usually say is that the north pole minus the south pole is zero. In equivariant homology, it's not true. The reason why it's not true, one way of saying why it's not true, is that this path itself is not U1 equivariant. And so there's a correction. The correction comes from applying the sort of sweep operation to this chain. So take this chain, sweep it around by the U1 action, multiply it by epsilon. Well, what do you get? Then you get the fundamental class of the two-sphere. So the relation is this class minus this class equals epsilon times the two sphere. But what does that become? So what are the operations associated to this? This is the operation of multiplying things in one order. This is the operation of multiplying them in the other order. And we just said that this one is the Poisson bracket. So that gives you the, so I'll just write it and then I'll finish.
So is epsilon an element in the cohomology of the classifying space of E1, or is it a number? What is epsilon?
This is the equivariant homology localized at epsilon. So, you know, think of it, how do you say it, right? The equivariant homology is like a module over C adjoint epsilon. And let's localize it. Think of epsilon as being an actual number. We're literally deforming the theory by some actual number here. Yeah, otherwise the description I think would be a little more complicated.
But that number, I mean, that usually is something not in degree zero.
Well, that's right. It has a degree here. I mean, right, these are classes in degree zero. You know, in the usual grading of ordinary homology, these are classes in degree zero, and this is a class in degree two. So this epsilon kind of has degree minus two in order to make the gradings add up. Okay, anyway, so this says phi one, phi two, minus phi two, phi one is some new operation, the new operation associated with the sphere at parameter epsilon. As epsilon goes to zero, you could write it like this. Limit as epsilon goes to zero, this divided by epsilon, it's supposed to go over to the ordinary Poisson bracket, and so that's the deformation quantization. Okay, so then you can imagine there's many other things you can try to do. So for example, one interesting thing you can do, which we explore a little bit in the paper, is to do these brackets not on local operators, but on extended operators. So you know, here this is in some sense related to the structure of EN algebra, but similarly, you know, the line defects are supposed to form EN categories, and so there's a lot of work to do, at least for me, to understand concretely what that structure means in the same sense as here we understand what this structure means. Okay, that's it, so thank you very much.
So we'll turn it over to the other side for questions first.
That's all right, Gina.
We didn't hear it the first time.
No, it's a
I'm sorry, Jörg, I couldn't hear what you said.
You can tell me what I should ask.
Yeah, so how does C in the commutator contain variant
other than epsilon correction? How you can see higher corrections in the commutator that you have.
Yeah, right. So the way I wrote it somehow. Right, so this is the thing that at first looks weird about this. So let me rewrite it the way I first wrote it. So what I wrote was that the difference of these two products is equal to this operator, this Poisson bracket. But we're not saying that it's equal to the original Poisson bracket at epsilon equals zero. In fact, to even say exactly what you mean by that would be a little bit subtle. All we're saying is that there's some operation here in the deformed theory, which I'll call the bracket sub epsilon in the theory with parameter epsilon. And the only thing we know about it is that its limit as epsilon goes to zero is the original Poisson bracket. So in a sense, the only thing we really use here is the statement that that limit exists. That's the sort of non-trivial thing that you get by this way of thinking, is that limit actually exists. And so then we write it this way. So you don't see, in other words, all the higher order corrections are sort of absorbed into the definition of bracket phi one, phi two sub epsilon in this way of writing it. So one might well be able to do better, but this is what you get sort of for free.
So I don't think there are questions here at the moment.
questions here.
So yesterday, Damien told us how to get EN algebras without any supersymmetry.
Yes.
He must have done something much more aggressive than taking a Q-cohomology. Are his EN algebras like obviously related to yours?
I mean, this.
So could also.
All right. So the question is, how are the EN algebras in this talk related to the EN algebras in Damien's talk? Okay. So, I mean, here I was just talking about the structure that we get. I was really talking about the structure that we get on homology. I didn't even talk much about the EN operator itself. I talked mostly about the homology of the EN operator. So I was interested in the situation where things are kind of where the translations are trivialized, right? And so we can, you know. So of course, if you don't impose any supersymmetry or anything, if you don't trivialize any translations, then you have. I mean, people here understand much better than me. But you know, my understanding is that this EN is just a way of encoding the statement that the product depends on the relative position, right? EN is like saying you have a family of operations that depend on the relative positions. So here I was talking about the special case where that dependence is trivialized, and so you know you can make these operations of the homology. If it's not trivialized, yeah, then I would expect some kind of more fledged. So as people here know much better than me, I would expect sort of the honest EN structure, not the homology. That's all I can say, but I'm certainly not the right person to answer this question, actually.
Yeah, so maybe I'll ask you, but I'm interested.
Yeah.
Chime in. So from this perspective, I mean, just from an abstract, say, math perspective, you could say, right, where you're studying EN algebras and then you're looking at equivariant forms of theory. So I'm curious if there's a, that's already been mapped out in the sense, like, you know, you could immediately ask questions like, let's say you take, I don't know if I have my indexing right, four algebras, yeah. And you look at there's a natural two torus.
Right.
You could ask what's the residual algebra, or I don't know, what's the equivariant algebraic structure? Is that
right?
Kind of.
So then it doesn't even have a product, right?
No doubt it's an important.
Yeah. So I personally don't know, and I think people on our team don't know sort of how much has been done in this area. This particular statement here, as far as we know, hadn't been said before. The fact that in this case you get the deformation quantization. So clearly there's a whole pile of questions like that. So this is just one very specific example.
Are there other questions here? So before we
thank Andy again, I'd like to mention I think that we have the wormholes up and running, so please feel free to reach out to the people on the other side or just show up and see who's over there. The other thing is that we'll try to have our speakers stick around for a moment so people on both sides can come up and ask their questions individually. So we'll have the next talk in a little over 20 minutes. All right.